censorship in religion administration of the President's Commission on Organized Crime from
1983 to 1986.
She was also
counsel
during the transition
period,
Carter to
Reagan transition, to the Economic Affairs Group.
That was, of course, in 1980.
She served in 1984 as co-chairman of the Lawyers
for
the Reagan-Bush campaign, and therefore
in both of these appointments was
very much in the midst of the political process. She was president, is president of the Republican National Lawyers Association.
And continues that activity into the present. Earlier, she served from 1975 to 1977, entirely in the Ford administration, as associate director of the domestic council in the White House.
So, in the political
sphere, she's had wide experience. And this has kept coming up when we
talked with people
who have
appeared before you earlier in the oral history proceedings, when they suggested you ought to try to get Judith Hope, who has some particular lines of knowledge and experience about President Reagan, to qualify her in the area of education and law is equally straightforward, I think. She was a graduate of Wellesley College, magna cum laude, and of the Harvard Law School, earning the JD degree. She currently is a senior partner, as I think we said in the material we sent out, of Paul, Hastings, Janofsky, and Walker. This is a Los Angeles firm, but it also has a Washington office, and she's liaison with the Washington office. She was formerly counsel in the law offices of Richard M. Coleman. Earlier than that, I was associated with a hyphenated law firm, Coleman et al., in Los Angeles. I have more trouble than Amanda Kane does in talking about law firms, because she has family reasons to know all these things. And she also was a partner in Wald, Harkrader, and Ross in Washington. She's had a teaching background, taught at the Harvard Law School, taught at Pepperdine University, and taught at the Georgetown University Law Center. She has several directorships. She's a director of Woodward and Lothrop, of Conrail, and of the Bud Company in Cincinnati. She has a Cincinnati connection, was born in Cincinnati. She was a trustee, and may still be, of the Federal City Council in Washington, of the Ford's Theater, of Meridian House International, and still somehow or another, with all these activities, has time for music, tennis, and mountain climbing. So I believe she will be, if she arrives, and we hope she will, a very interesting person. I thought I might just say a word about the kind of detective activity that goes into one of these oral history efforts. It isn't very difficult to check off the names on the government printing office lists of cabinet members in each administration, people who occupied very important positions. But it's much more difficult to try to find out who had the ear, who was a confidant, who was somebody who had a long association and friendship with the president. We have found this to be particularly true of the Reagan administration. Edmund Morris, the official biographer of Reagan, will be coming, we hope, to an event such as this sometime this spring. But a couple of us had a private session with him, and this was one of the things he talked about, the relatively small number of people who were close to the president. Partly he attributed that to the fact that, as he used the term, President Reagan does not disclose himself to people. He made the point that even with Nancy Reagan, the curtain goes down at a certain point, and there are not... there's not, there apparently is not a great disposition to share confidences or disclose himself in the way that some presidents, Gerald Ford perhaps, and others have done. And so we have been looking for people, and in a moment I'll bring in one who... Mrs. Hope won't be able to deny anything that I've said, but I
deny it all.
But I qualified the witness in your absence, and everybody's agreed that you're the best possible person
we could have
to talk
to. Oh, dear. Well, if my ability to find my way around the campus of the University of Virginia is any test, I'm going to get an F this morning. But it's a beautiful campus. I've seen all of it. How would you like to begin?
Well, would you like to just kick off with either a few words on the commission or on what we've done with a number of people is to ask the question, when did you first meet the president? What were your impressions of him as a leader?
Why don't I start with a few words about the President's Commission on Organized Crime?
Great.
And then you can ask me whatever questions, and I'd be pleased to answer them.
Good.
With the caveat that I was not really inside. I was really outside looking in from a close perspective, but I was not an insider. Okay?
Good.
The question really, this is the final report of and that's called the summary volume. It looks pretty heavy, but that's the summary of the work of the President's Commission on Organized Crime, which took about 3 years and was the first major national commission on organized crime since the Kefauver Commission. The President's Commission on Organized Crime grew out of some internal discussions that people in the Justice Department had at the time of the transition from the Carter presidency to the Reagan presidency. And they set up at that time, as you may remember, a task force on crime, which was co-chaired by Griffin Bell, who had been Attorney General for President Carter, and Jim Thompson, who was the governor of Illinois. And out of that commission, there came a number of recommendations. There was a great focus even then, and that was 1981, on drugs. And there was a feeling and a strong recommendation that something should be done about drugs by the federal government in a major and coordinated way. Out of the analysis and discussion of drugs came the thought and the conviction that organized crime was a major force involved in drugs, and that it was more than just the Cosa Nostra, that it was organized crime groups all over the world, and that it was emerging groups, not only the Chinese Tongs and the Yakuza from Japan, but the Colombian cartels, the motorcycle gangs, which were the enforcers as well as distributors of drugs in certain parts of this country. And therefore, there should be a major effort and a new look at what was going on in organized crime, because the Kefauver Commission, as you all know, dealt primarily with and identified the Cosa Nostra, the mafia, and that was the beginning of the use of that term. So it came to pass that the president in 1983 announced the formation of the Crime Commission, and that started our work. A number of people, about 20 people, were chosen as commissioners. Judge Irving Kaufman of the Second Circuit was chosen as the chairman. He's a sitting federal judge and one of the most respected and the longest sitting federal judges in the United States. He's just, in fact, celebrated his 40th anniversary on the bench. And two vice chairmen were selected. One was Sam Skinner, who is now the Secretary of Transportation. And those of us who didn't do quite so well, the other one was me. And I'm a lawyer in private practice in Washington, D.C. We had hearings all over the United States. We had a professional staff of investigators and former United States, assistant United States attorneys. And we explored in public forums What had happened to organized crime since the last study had been done. We made recommendations for legislation, much of which was passed, and we had some success in a few areas. The major successes, I think, that we had were a new look at money laundering and the way that casinos and money exchanges like Deep Pereira were used to launder the money of organized crime. Our report on that was called The Cash Connection, and there was major legislation in the Congress which changed the rules as to what a bank was, because formerly a bank, as you may know, had to report all transactions of $10,000 or more in cash. But is a casino a bank? Is Deep Pereira a bank? And so forth. And these entities were or became subject to the rules with respect to reporting any transaction of $10,000 or more in cash. We did a very extensive study of the unions in the United States and found that four of them had been taken over essentially by organized crime. The Teamsters, the laborers, the longshoremen. Now I've got a mental block, but I'll come back. There's one more. Well, we had four that were taken over, and the report that we did on that eventually led to some very major Justice Department investigations, particularly of the Teamsters. And as you know, the Teamsters eventually went into a kind of receivership and in an attempt to clean up that union. We did a lot of work on drug testing. It was very controversial. Should people in sensitive positions be subjected to drug testing? Airline pilots, for example, people in the CIA, people in the FBI. It was very controversial, and the commission was severely attacked for interfering with civil liberties. There were a number of lawsuits filed all over the United States, and most of those lawsuits said as long as the standards were carefully defined, drug testing was appropriate and constitutional, and now there is drug testing in the railroad industry, for example, and in the airline industry. And that started with the President's Commission on Organized Crime. We didn't do all that we should have. We had a one-year fight after we began over whether we could have subpoena power. And finally, a year after we began, the Congress finally passed subpoena power, which enabled us to require people to testify before us, to produce documents. And that without that, I think that the Commission's work would have been very, pretty much insignificant. But with the subpoena power, which was a major battle, we were able to do some things, but our charter ran out before we could complete our work. So that's the beginning of the President's Commission on Organized Crime, and why don't we just talk about whatever you would like to talk about.
May I ask the first question? Was the initiative for the commission a presidential initiative, or did the push come from other places?
It's my strong belief that it grew out of this commission that was initially appointed by President Reagan to take a look at criminal justice in the United States, and that it worked up from that commission and from the people in the Justice Department. William French Smith was the Attorney General at the time, and Ed Meese, who was out of law enforcement, was the counselor to the president. He was at the White House, and I think the two of them worked very closely together and with Governor Thompson and Judge Bell to develop ideas, but with the initial appointment by the president of that commission to study criminal justice, the ideas percolated up to the president. He did not say, we need an organized crime commission.
Had he done anything like this in California?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that, but I do remember when we met with him in the Oval Office, Judge Kaufman and I met with him to present the report on labor racketeering, which was a very harsh report about the really frightening condition of some of the labor unions in the country. He talked about how he had had to fight that when he was head of the Screen Actors Guild, which was a union, and how elements of organized crime had tried to get into the movie business and into control of certain aspects of the Screen Actors Guild. So I think he had some knowledge of it, but I don't know whether he actually did anything like this when he was governor.
Was the drug part of the problem present from the beginning?
From the beginning. There was a recognition immediately in 1981 that there was a serious drug problem in this country. And there was a recognition that the federal government and the state and local officials had to work more closely together on it. And I think there was a lot of progress during the Reagan administration on that. There was a great deal of support for local law enforcement. And, you know, the FBI always had the reputation of being pretty hard to deal with, that they would keep their information to themselves, and they were an effective but very elite group. There was a considerable increase in cooperation between the FBI and state and local law enforcement during the 8 years of the Reagan presidency, in my observation.
One last question. We've read so much about Mrs. Reagan's interest in drugs. Was the president himself equally interested as you observed it? Or was this an area where Mrs. Reagan exercised influence on the president?
I can't really answer that. He seemed interested, but he really, once he had delegated that issue to the Justice Department and to the FBI, I think he pretty much stayed out of it. He was concerned, he was interested, but it wasn't a driving passion of his personally, from my observation.
Why don't we turn to the group?
Tell me, who are these distinguished people? I thought you and I were going to have a conversation over a cup of coffee this morning.
Well, we were until I heard about you.
Yeah, this is quite a distinguished looking group of people. Who are all these wonderful people?
Well, they're academicians, they're retired public officials, they're people who have been leaders in the community, they're
the next prime minister of Turkey, and our graduate students like Renee Eder. And
they may know more than I.
I doubt
if
it.
You want to tell me when I make a mistake, don't hesitate.
Okay. Howard, did you?
In your work, was there any information fed into the commission that would involve Nari Eagle?
No. No. We didn't. If we got information about drug running out of Latin America, I don't recall that his name was ever on any of that. All the members of the commission had top secret clearances, and we saw a lot of things about drug running, but I don't recall anything about Noriega. It's a good question.
Thanks. Yes.
Legalizing drugs.
Yes. There was a debate about that. There was a lot of discussion about it. And I think that the weight of the testimony and the weight of the evidence that we examined was definitely opposed to legalizing drugs on the theory that, or two theories really, as I recall it. One, that it would enslave the lower socioeconomic portions of the population. And two, that a lot of people who take drugs, like PCP and other things, become very serious law enforcement problems. There are serious problems on the highways. There are serious problems in neighborhoods, domestic violence, because they are completely out of control. And the law enforcement people didn't think that a way to solve that problem was to legalize the drugs, because they would still have the behavioral problems to deal with. We still have that problem anyway. That's very, very true. But that was the way it was viewed at that time.
Dr. Aldrich?
You said, Mr. Hope, that your charter ran out before you could complete the work you would like
yes.
to have done. Had you had another year, what other areas would you have investigated?
Well, I think we would have done a number of things. We would have pushed a lot more legislation than we did. More legislation in the labor union area, more legislation in the drug area. We would have investigated in much greater detail the impact of the emerging organized crime groups. We were only able to skim the surface of all of those things. And we really, I think, although we made a report which has become a kind of a Bible for law enforcement in many parts of the world, the report is unfinished. It doesn't examine the entire problem in this country. It didn't deal, for example, in the kind of detail that we wished with the role of the Justice Department and the role of the FBI and whether they were doing their job as well as could be, what changes needed to be made. And the very question about drugs was one. We identified the problem. We came up with no solutions whatsoever as to how to deal with the problem, how to make it better. And the year that we didn't have subpoena power really cost us a great deal, I think. So there's a lot remaining to be done. One of the recommendations of the commission that was that some sort of a permanent commission be established as an ongoing, not as a massive an effort, but an ongoing effort to identify these problems and see if we could not make some progress. But that recommendation has never been acted on.
Henry Thielbar.
That your last point about the ongoing commission is something that I was going to bring up. Is there a possibility that an efficient unit of government could be set up, say within the administration or a separate agency, which would operate on a continuing basis, studying this type of problem or other problems, rather than having a commission that's brought in for a limited period of time? I can see the advantage of having the commission such as yours, because you have then the opportunity to bring in people who are specialists and are particularly good in certain areas. But the same thing could be done if it were a permanent body. Is that just completely off the wall? Or?
No, I think it's a great idea. And I think it should definitely, in my view, it should definitely be done. A smaller group, but well-respected, not full-time government employees, but a permanent commission comprised of a small professional staff and outside people who would focus on this issue and would have available to them the resources that we did, the FBI, to some extent CIA reports, the Justice Department, local law enforcement reports, because this is it is not a problem which is getting less in this country. It is a problem which is becoming more and more serious. One of the most serious problems, for example, now is the Yakuza, the Japanese organized crime groups, which are operating here not only as enforcers for the casinos, for Japanese tourists who go and gamble and don't pay their gambling debts, and they used to use the Yakuza in Japan to collect those debts, but now they're operating here to do loan sharking, and they're involved in drugs, and they are very tough. Actually, the mafia look kind of like petunias compared to some of the groups that are operating now. The Colombian drug lords are completely vicious, and I think we need a constant focus. A constant focus on organized crime, because people don't realize, as they go to a restaurant or they engage in picking up things from a dock, or they hire somebody to build a big building in New York or New Jersey or perhaps here in Virginia, I don't know about Virginia so much, that organized crime is taking a piece of that, and it's costing every one of us extra money and some kind of loss of control. So I think it should be permanent. I think it's a major initiative that ought to be accomplished as soon as possible. There's a woman over back there.
Yes. Professor Fernbach?
No, it's a lady.
Oh, lady. Betsy Raspis. Right?
This is an appropriate time for me to ask a question. I've always been curious about it. It sounds radical, I don't mean it to be, but one question is, do you think the mafia runs the government, or does the government run the mafia? And my other question is, if there was a permanent board to do this, which I think would be an excellent idea, would it be conceivable that they would be able to get to information and answers, or is the mafia so infiltrated in our government that there'd be a blockage?
Well, I don't know. What do you mean? Federal government? The mafia and the federal
All
government?
Well, everything that rules us.
Well, you know, I don't think that the mafia runs the federal government. I don't think that they do. And I really want to emphasize that organized crime is so much larger today than the Cosa Nostra, so much bigger, and in a way so much more vicious, that we must remember always to focus more broadly than just the mafia.
Excuse me, I meant organized crime.
Yeah.
To me, mafia is
I think that there are elements of organized crime in a number of government entities around the country. It may be local government, it may be state government. It may be pieces of state government. You have to look at things where there's a lot of cash flow, where there aren't a whole lot of receipts. That's the kind of thing that organized crime likes. And there are influences throughout this country, and they try to infiltrate certain segments of government entities. But Do they control it? No, I don't think so. Not at all. But I think that vigilance is very important. The Attorney General Thornburg has just disbanded the strike force, the organized crime strike force, turning it back to the local law enforcement and to the local U.S. attorneys rather than a centralized strike force in Washington. That may be a good thing, but it will be very important to watch carefully that the vigilance and the prosecution of organized crime officials continues. It was very much a priority in the Reagan administration, and a lot of Cosa Nostra dons were brought to trial and were incarcerated. It's too soon in the Bush administration to know, but that was a major priority, and it must continue, in my view, because it is very dangerous. They have a lot of money. They have extraordinary amount of money from drugs, and that's corrupting. It corrupts police forces. It corrupts attorney general's offices in states. It's a great threat to our civilized society, in my view.
So and they also, you're saying, they have an awful lot of power. That money gives them power?
Yes, I think so. But they aren't in charge yet, as far as I know. Not most places. Some places they may be.
What do you do when a husband and a wife both want to ask a question?
I was just going to ask why the FBI doesn't take care of this problem. I thought that's what it was supposed to be for. The National Crime Prevention.
Well, the FBI is an investigative bureau. It's not a prosecuting bureau. And they do have a major role and a major emphasis on investigating organized crime. They have a lot of agents.
A lot of their agents are lawyers.
Yes. But the people who have to prosecute are the state and local and federal prosecutors, the United States attorneys around the country. They have to bring indictments, and people are entitled, and rightly so, to fair trials. All the FBI does is try to get the information, and they do that regularly.
No, in due time.
One wonders about bottlenecks in this whole question. Are there enough prosecutors? Are there enough court facilities? Do delays hamper the investigatory work, et cetera, et cetera? Did you highlight the bottlenecks? And also one wonders about the bottlenecks of the flow. For example, you said that big cash flow is something you can get hold of, perhaps, and do something to get hold of the problem. Are there other such evidences that lead you in certain directions that might get a grip on some of the problem?
Well, those are very profound questions. I'm not a prosecutor, and I don't have the immediate hands-on experience to answer as capably as I would like. I think that there probably are enough prosecutors. There are very definitely not enough federal judges. There are 57 or so vacancies on the federal courts right now, and they need to be filled. And many of the vacancies are on the federal district court, and drug cases come before federal district judges. The vast majority, for example, of the trial docket in the federal court in Miami is drug cases. That's what they deal with. Are there enough jails? No, there aren't, in my judgment, which means that a lot of the drug lords get off easy, get out early, and they view going to jail just as part of the cost of doing business. I have to spend a couple of years in the pen to make $15 million a year when I get out. So there are a lot of things that I think should be done, but it's a question of allocating resources. And jails are expensive, and federal judges are not very expensive, but they are endangered right now. You know, people are sending them bombs and trying to knock them off. And if we're not careful about that, we're going to have the same kind of situation here that we have in Columbia, where nobody wants to be a judge. In terms of bottlenecks, that's a really good point. And I think that when we talked earlier, when I answered this gentleman's question, I think one of the things that the Organized Crime Commission didn't get to was the bottlenecks. And one of the things we wanted to look at was bottlenecks and also the role of the federal law enforcement, the role of the Justice Department, and what more could be done, and how could the process become more rapid. And we didn't get to that, but I'm sure there are bottlenecks, and they need to be opened up, cleared out. Because it's my view and it's my philosophy that people who engage in organized criminal activity should understand that they will be searched out and they will be prosecuted, and justice will be very swift and the punishment will be very severe. That's my view. And we need people and judges and jails, and we need an investigative force that has the capability and the manpower, the person power, to do that. And I don't know that we have enough. In many areas, we do not have enough of those things.
Did the commission ever talk, speaking of severe justice, about Bill Bennett's idea that the drug lords ought to be beheaded?
No, we never discussed that. We never discussed that.
Professor Bierstein?
I'm such an innocent, I don't know what money laundering means. Can you explain the process to me? Not that I have any to launder.
Well, one of the things we found, for example, was that people would come into casinos with green grocery bags full of $100 bills, large green trash bags full of $100 bills. They would turn them into the casino and get chips. They would gamble for 20 minutes, and they would take their chips back to the cashier and get cash. And they might not get, they might get a cashier's check. They might get $20 bills. They might get credit at a local bank, which they could then write a check on and send the check to Switzerland or the Grand Turks and Caicos Islands. In other words, they had $100 bills which could be marked, could be traced to some kind of a drug transaction. And by trading it in a casino, they would cleanse the money and it could no longer be traced to the source, which was a drug transaction or a number of drug transactions. Similarly, when the Organized Crime Commission focused in on the Deke Pereira operations, because they were not banks, so they didn't have to report these $10,000 cash transactions again, they closed some of their South American and Latin American operations subsidiaries. Because once the drug lords realized that the FBI and the CIA and the President's Crime Commission was going to look at and watch the transactions in a company which legitimately changed money, the drug lords would not deal with Deke Pereira anymore, and therefore they couldn't make a profit and they closed. And Mr. Deke testified before the commission. He was very angry. He said that they had no reason to know any of this money was tainted in any way, and the commission had no business interfering with legitimate operations of currency transactions. But we had checks of, you know, many millions of dollars that they would write Deke Pereira to someone who would bring cash in. Let's say they brought American dollars and Deke Pereira would give them a $15 million check in Swiss francs or Deutsche Marks or a combination of yen and English pounds. That's not sort of the kind of thing that doesn't make you wonder why these people are doing this. And of course, Deke Pereira got a commission, got a percentage, a small percentage of the transaction as they changed the currency. So they were, whether or not they knew, we thought they should have known, because it's not the ordinary course of a tourist coming in and saying, I'm going to France and I need $1,000 in francs, when somebody is changing $15 million a week. That's something that you ought to wonder about, we said. And that's what money laundering is. And it's a real problem for organized crime, because they have a lot, as I said earlier, organized crime likes transactions which are cash intensive. They don't like bank records. They don't like checking accounts. They don't like anything that can be traced. So they deal in cash. And whether it's prostitution or loan sharking or drugs or whatever it is, they like to deal in cash. Then they have a lot of cash. And they couldn't any longer put the cash in a bank, because if it was $10,000, the bank had to report to the Treasury, and the Treasury had a cross-check with the FBI, and they would be caught up. So they tried to find other ways, whether through international currency transactions, through casinos, other ways that they could turn the cash into something that could not be traced. And the Crime Commission, in its report, The Cash Connection, called attention to that. A number of banks also had been very sloppy, is probably the right word, about enforcing this $10,000 rule. And a number of banks, including one in Boston and one in New York, paid major fines, because we said, look, you're not following the existing law. And so the banks stopped participating in the money laundering. The casinos stopped, as far as we know, and the Dique Pereira's Latin American operations closed. And there's no question that money laundering continues to occur, but it's much harder. And therefore, the organized crime people have a greater chance of being caught as they try to turn their illicit profits into clean cash, which they can put in businesses, legitimate businesses, and real estate and other things, because they want to cash out. We want to stop them.
Would you be willing to talk for just a moment or two about your impressions of the president? Recently, a couple of us had a session, as you may have had, too, with Edmund Morris, the biographer, and he spoke about the fact that he had known few, if any, persons who at a certain point disclosed themselves less when questions were asked. And one has the impression that historians are going to be searching for a long time to get to their final judgments on President Reagan. The Morning News carried this account of his comment about Hinckley. I don't know if you heard it
on
the car radio, but somebody asked him, didn't he hate that young man? And he said, no, he hadn't heard about him at the time of the hospitalization, but later he heard, and he seemed to have been a very mixed up, confused young man. And he said when he heard all about it, he began to include Hinckley in his prayers. Well, that's an aspect of Reagan that we probably will be wondering about. Is it show? Is it genuine? Is it, you're Cincinnati and I'm central Wisconsin? And it reminds me a little of some things I grew up with people who one thought were genuinely very sincere and who did make comments like that. But every time we've done an oral history, while we've heard two things. One, this is a new kind of presidency. Carter's presidency was a different presidency, we were told in our oral history. And secondly, we were told that this president was in many ways unique. Well, if President Reagan was unique, what was the uniqueness? How would you, in just beginning to talk a little about it, how would you describe him, his leadership, his strengths, any limitations, and his presidency in general?
Could you repeat the question? well, I first met Ronald Reagan, not worked for him, but just met him at a dinner in Palm Springs, California, when he was governor of California. And he was, he then appeared to me as he appeared to me through much of the White House. He knew how to handle high office without letting himself get bogged down in it. He had a lot of fun in his life, seemed to me, in California. But he did a lot of good things for the state. And he was criticized for a lot of other things. But he did a lot of good things for the state. And he was a kid from the Midwest. Because he didn't have a lot of money when he was young. And I think that goes with him to this day. He doesn't like debt, although the debt certainly increased during his presidency. But he doesn't like it as a personal thing. And he's not a scholar, but he is not a shallow man, in my judgment. There was a very clear sense whenever I met with him, when he was governor of California and later when he was president, that he knew exactly what he thought was right. And many people disagreed, but he knew, and other people dealing with him, and as a lawyer in Washington dealing with his administration, we were very clear where that administration was coming from in most things. There was an ideological stripe to the administration, and you knew where it stood. Whether or not you agreed with it, you knew where it stood, and he knew where he stood. He has been called the great communicator, and rightly so. And perhaps that's, in terms of changing what the presidency is, perhaps that is a major change. He was very popular, even though his policies were not popular often. People who would normally be middle-of-the-road Democrats would vote for him because they trusted him, even though on many things they didn't agree with him. I know many, many women, for example, who didn't agree with his abortion policies at all, who voted for him because they thought he was strong on national defense and they thought that was an even more important issue. But in terms of communicating, I think what he did was make America feel good about itself again. And I don't think America felt very good about itself during the Carter administration. That may not be President Carter's fault, but I believe that is true. And President Reagan made America feel proud to be this country, made America feel strong in the world, and in control of their own destiny. And for whatever reason, the economic boom that occurred during the Reagan years made everybody feel pretty good. So I think that was a major change. The emphasis on portraying this country in a strong light, his ability to communicate that vision. And I think that his defense policy made people feel safe. Peace through strength, I think, really occurred. And a lot of people say, and I would be one of them, except I'm not a scholar in this, that Gorbachev should not have been the man on the cover of Time magazine as the man of the decade, but that Reagan's defense policies and his determination to force the Soviet Union to its knees in terms of its satellite countries was the reason for the current breakdown in the communist empire in Eastern Europe. I believe that. It was very expensive for the American people, but I think we felt good about it. And I think that's a change. I don't think there'll be another president like Reagan for some time. It's hard to match that level of euphoria. But certainly in personal meetings with him, he was quite a bit above the fray, but he absolutely knew what was going on and knew where he wanted to go. Whether or not you wanted to follow, that was something else. But he knew where he wanted to go, even in meetings on issues on the Crime Commission. He wanted to be tough on crime. There was no question about it. And he wanted it to move, the Crime Commission to move its agenda as quickly as possible and as hard as possible. And I think he felt the same way about defense.
Any other questions? Yes.
It sounds like a simple question, but it concerns me. Do you think the average person knows enough about what's going on? And is it important that they do? There's so much going on in our country now. I don't think people think about it enough or care about it enough. I think they let it slide over their shoulders. If they had more information, don't you think that would be somehow?
Well, you know, you're asking me a very personal question, but it, in a way it relates to the question before. Yes, I think people need more information, and I don't think most people want it. More and more, all the statistics will show, and you probably know this better than I do, people aren't reading newspapers. Students, and here I am in the part of one of the great universities of the world, students are not as intellectual, I think. I have two kids in college, as they were when I was in college. They're just as smart, maybe smarter. But in terms of the tough intellectual interest across the spectrum of students, I don't see it as much as I did when I was in college. And, you know, I suppose that that's been said since the time of Socrates. Boy, the younger generation's going to hell in a handbasket. But I think that part of the way I think your question relates to the earlier question is that part of the brilliance of Ronald Reagan was his ability to encapsulate complicated ideas in a very simple form and to sell that simple idea, and he had all the best PR people and advertising people in the world helping him. But the you know, the 1984 campaign video of the bear in the woods. If you're going to have a bear in the woods, isn't it good to have someone with a gun? Very simple. Very persuasive. What did most American people think about what that really means in terms of missiles on the border of between China and Russia, or missiles in Germany, or throw weights of whatever? No, I don't think most Americans think about it or care about it nor want to learn about it. They're much more interested in, you try to talk to somebody on national defense when the World Series is on, and I guarantee you, you won't get anybody to listen. And even if it's not a playoff game or not a series game, we aren't as serious as a country as I think we should be. We really aren't. People don't want details. They want a paycheck, and they want a nice house, and they want their kids to be okay and safe. And they want somebody else to take care of everything. I think that's the general mood. And that mood was perceived by the Reagan people, and they could reduce it to things like the Bear in the Woods ad. And it was a brilliant ad, but not at all. It captured the mood, but not at all the complexities of the national defense issues of 6 years ago. So I don't know what you do about that. I have a hard time getting my son to read the newspaper, too. And he's very smart. But he'll read the box scores before he reads the headlines every time. And he's 21 years old. I don't know what to do about it. My daughter's different.
I'm there in the woods. Is there? Were you a little disappointed, or did he do everything he could after he began the summit talks? Remember, the neoconservatives put out, Midge Dexter and others put out this bear
englobing Reagan in an embrace and attacking him for the contacts. And his response was that when they asked, why are you talking with this man, he said, he's different, and the others all kept dying. And that's maybe that's about all the public can grasp, is that there are different leaders. Yeah. But then is the legacy likely to sustain you when Gorbachev, as a result of Lithuania or anything else, disappears from view? If you haven't laid the foundations for the fact that in addition to strength, you do, as he did, move in directions of accommodation, and that accommodation is part and parcel of all of international politics, from not only the Treaty of Westphalia, but from the Babylonians. And did he give us the right legacy on matters of that kind, or is it impossible to communicate complicated ideas like that?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in foreign affairs, so I don't really know. But and I think it's too early to tell. But I think this, you know, you're trying here. We're all trying to get a sense of the man for the president. And I'm glad you brought up that point. He's different. That comment, because I think one of the strengths of Ronald Reagan, as I observed him personally, was he had a great sense of people. Maybe that's why he was a good actor. And certainly it had something to do with why he was a good communicator. I think he had an insight into people. And I think he decided to trust but verify, but he decided to trust Gorbachev. And of course, presidents have, I worked in the White House for President Ford, presidents have an enormous amount of information at their disposal. And one of the things I'm sure President Reagan had at his disposal for a long time was an understanding of the Soviet economy and how this defense buildup was breaking the economy and destroying the spirit of the Soviet people. And I'm sure, knowing some of the advisors who advised President Reagan on foreign policy, that they pointed out to him that if we were strong, the Soviet Union, because our economy was so much more powerful than theirs, the Soviet Union could not keep up. And therefore, inevitably, they would have to come apart one way or another. And I think Gorbachev also understood that very quickly, and thus the accommodation began. I think that if this is the end of communism as we have known it since the early part of this century, that will be an extraordinary legacy. And I think it's legitimately Reagan's legacy. Extraordinary.
Dr. Alters.
To go back to the Commission on Organized Crime, did you find it difficult to contain the agenda? I'm specifically talking about your discussion of drug testing, which seems somehow more to do with interstate commerce or to do with civil liberties than with organized crime. The other question about the commission, was it too cumbersome? You mentioned that a permanent commission should be smaller, or do you have would you have suggestions as to how it might better have been organized in the first place?
Was it hard to contain the commission? Yes. It was hard to get our priorities straight. We had relatively limited budget, and we had, by the time we got our subpoena power, a too limited period of time in which to do our work. We had a lot of strong-minded people on the commission, which was, I think, very good. And part of the final report, if you ever read it, which I read some of it last night, but it's double-spaced and has big margins. That's the way I talk to my 21-year-old son. But there, a lot of it are dissenting opinions or additional opinions of individual commissioners on various subjects, particularly on labor racketeering. I actually think that's good. But in terms of focus, I think a smaller group without trying, so we had to vote on everything. So a smaller group where you didn't have 21 votes, but you maybe had 10 votes, would make you twice as efficient. They could still be as strong-willed, but there wouldn't be so many people to try to accommodate. And And I think that would be good. I think that a small professional staff, full-time staff, who could be directed by a commission would work better now. I think we needed the overview, but it would work better now. I think I've forgotten some portion of your question.
Did your investigation include organized lobbying to see if there were criminal elements there?
No. Do you think there are?
Well, I think by the response of the group here, I think some would suspect that there is.
Well, lobbyists certainly have an enormous amount of power, but whether they would rise to the level of organized crime, I don't know. I don't think so. But they certainly have a lot of power, and that's a whole subject for another day, but the cash connection in terms of American politics at the federal level is frightening. But that's not our subject today, but it's really... And it takes $20 to $30 million to run a gubernatorial campaign for one candidate in California. There's something wrong.
Yes, Arthur Stock.
Would you care to comment on the constitutional, legal, or mechanical problems involved in dealing with major drug distributors who are foreign nationals?
Yes.
The Colombian drug lords, Noriega, and so forth. Is it really practicable to indict them in federal court in Miami?
Boy, I'm going to give you that hot potato right back, but I'll give you an idea of what I think, and then I'd like to hear your views. I think it's going to be very difficult to change. If Noriega is convicted, it will be very difficult to change what is now a kind of a test case. I have read that courts don't really look at how a criminal defendant gets into the country, even though we probably didn't have any right to bring Noriega here. Once he's here, he's tried under U.S. laws. I think there are major legal questions about trying foreign nationals in U.S. courts. It troubles me, and that does not say that I think Mr. Noriega is a nice man. I don't think he's a nice man at all, and I think he has done terrible damage to the United States in participating in the drug cartels and the drug running into this country. But, you know, if we had somebody here who was an organized criminal, who, let's say, was running guns to Israel, and the Saudis decided to indict an American citizen in Saudi Arabia for running guns to Israel, which guns were used to shoot at the Arabs. Or you can say that he was running guns to the Arabs, and the Israelis indicted him. Doesn't matter. I'm not trying to take a position on the difficulties in the Middle East. And they then invaded the United States to get this person and took this person back to the Middle East for trial. I think we would be outraged. I think we would think that was a denial. Even if the man was Al Capone, we would think that was a denial of not only an individual's right to a fair trial in this country, but our constitutional guarantees. And I grew up as a lawyer, working for Edward Bennett Williams. That's where I started. I started as a criminal defense lawyer. In fact, I was the only person on the Organized Crime Commission who really knew firsthand what the mafia was about, because when I was working for Ed Williams, a lot of his clients had famous Italian last names and Sicilian last names, so I really knew. But that experience for me made me very convinced that the individual rights that we have guaranteed under our Constitution are the most important things that we have as citizens. and that trials have to be fair and the laws have to be followed, particularly in the case of the bad guys. Because if you break the rules for the bad guys, pretty soon all of us good guys are at risk. So I think it's a kind of a dangerous precedent with respect to Mr. Noriega. I will be interested to see how the courts handle it. I guess there's nothing wrong with indicting him here, and if he happens to come into our jurisdiction, to arresting him and trying him. But the whole combination of events, while it makes you proud as an American, is a little frightening as a precedent. That's my view.
Thank you.
Is there any basis for extraterritorial application of American laws? In other words, we have laws against all these crimes that are being committed. But this act, as far as I can read from the newspapers, by Noriega, took place in Panama. So what is the basis for justification? Now, his lawyers keep talking about attacking the jurisdiction and the head of state and a lot of other garbage, but I haven't heard him say anything along the lines that we have been talking about. Maybe they just don't want to disclose it, but you assume they have that very much in mind?
Oh, I'm sure they do. I think this will be... it may end up being one of the most important constitutional law cases of this century. But it will go off on a procedural ground as to how he got to the United States.
Are there any bases and other instances where there's been an extraterritorial application of local laws against events that took place in some other country?
I don't know.
Airplane hijacking is one.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. I'm not an expert in that area, and I don't know, but I think it's going to be tough.
Since Panama turned him down, I mean, they didn't want him.
So
doesn't that give us more people, right?
Well, we certainly have a right to try him once he's here. The question is, did we have a right to bring him here? And the book is not written on that yet. I mean, he allegedly surrendered. But what kind of ultimatums we gave him. I mean, he negotiated all sorts of things, safe passage for his children and his family to Cuba and all sorts of things. Whether that was, in any sense, an act of his own free will that he turned himself in and allowed himself to be brought to the United States, I don't know. It's a very kind of murky legal area. But my feeling is that once he's here, we're going to try him, and the courts, over the precedent that I have looked at, doesn't pay attention to how he got here. But I'm sure his lawyers will eventually raise it. And we also may pay a big price in Latin America for our invasion eventually, you know, over the long run. But it sure felt good while it was going on.
Now we have to pray to the victims.
Well... Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure. I don't have any idea how strong the case is. I'm sure he did all the things that he was charged with and more, but whether it can be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, I don't know. But he'll certainly be out of circulation for a while, and that may break his... talk about an organized criminal. That'll certainly break his lines of communication with his cartel down there in Panama and Colombia. That'll be a good thing. I just hope he lives to see trial. You know, it would be the worst thing in the world if he were killed in jail. We never get beyond that, not for a long time.
Most people don't live up to their press clippings. I think most of you would very readily agree that Mrs. Hope has. You've shown great restraint in not asking anything about her father-in-law, about Wellesley. If Amanda Kane on behalf of her late husband wants to ask a question about the Harvard Corporation, why, she can do that, but otherwise I think we ought to stand adjourned. Do you care to...
Okay.
now. Took them 352 years.
Yes.
Imagine what they're going to do 350 years from now.
Her husband was on the corporation.
Oh, really? Well, you know how it is on the inside then. Quite a fascinating place. I'm sure there's something similar here at the University of Virginia.
Sure. It takes time.
Yeah. Well, I will just say this about the Harvard Corporation. You know, you serve without a term, which is the way they put it. But they start pushing you out at 70, I understand. I'm the youngest member of the Harvard Corporation. It's the first time in my life I've felt if I don't agree with somebody, I can just outweigh them.